When John F. Kennedy was campaigning to be president, he spoke to the ideals of young Americans. He proposed a new type of service where Americans, with all their advantages, could volunteer to help out in developing countries around the world. Growing up in New Jersey, George Goryeb was intrigued by this new Peace Corps that was emerging. He volunteered to teach English in Morocco right out of college. As the son of Christian Arab immigrants from the Middle East, George had an advantage in being fluent in Arabic. His years in Morocco and Yemen showed George how misguided American presumptions about life in an Arabic country can be, both about the culture and about its main religion. In fact, this former altar boy developed an appreciation for the Muslim faith that he saw practiced by his students and friends. Since then, George Goryeb has served as the chairman of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee and co-founded the Middle East Peace Project in New York. George joins us now on Travel with Rick Steves during this Ramadan season in Islam to explain what he admires about the religion of his Muslim neighbors.
Thank you so much, Rick. I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, George, you were born and raised in New Jersey, but your parents immigrated from the Middle East, from Lebanon and Syria, right?
That's correct. Christian on both sides.
Christians on both sides. And I've always enjoyed talking to you about the complexities of the Middle East, and it's always been frustrating to me how hard it is for Americans to understand the different religions and how they relate to each other. Some people might wonder, well, how can a Christian Arab help Americans, whether they're Christians or not, understand Islam? How do you defend that idea?
I would defend it this way. I grew up in New Jersey with many of the same myths and fallacies about Muslims that I believed in myself. I didn't know any Muslims as a teenager. In high school, I went to a Catholic high school. I had intended to become a Catholic priest, and I went to a Catholic college. But when I graduated college and I joined the Peace Corps and they sent me to North Africa, that was my first exposure to living and working and being with Muslims all day, every day. And that opened my eyes to what the truth is. And now that I'm back in America for literally the last 40 years, I've tried to share my life experiences with living and working and being with Muslims so that they could find out some truths about them and debunk so many myths.
And, you know, religion's all about just getting close to God. And when you do get to know Islam, God is everywhere, inshallah.
Yes.
Give a couple of examples of how God permeates their society.
There were many things I loved about living in a Muslim society, but one of them was, it was obvious to me after a couple of months that God was really a part of their lives in a way that I had never experienced in Christianity. They mentioned God's name all day, every day. Nothing happens in life without the expression Alhamdulillah, which means praise be to God. If somebody asks you, how are you? Your answer is not, oh, I'm feeling pretty good. Things are great. You give praise to God. If you talk about something in the future in the Arabic language, you end that sentence or begin that sentence with the phrase Inshallah, which means God willing. You're constantly reminding yourself that God is a part of your life and you live that way. That's why I was so impressed with Islam is more than a religion. It's a way of life. It's a way of living.
George, we both understand the importance of the two massive societies, Christendom and Islam, making bridges instead of walls, and we do that through travel. How can you illustrate the sadness of how little American Christians would know about Islamic communities on the other side of the world?
Try to imagine a young boy who grows up somewhere in an African or Asian country in a Muslim nation, who's never had the opportunity to learn anything about Christianity. And let's imagine that he's never read anything about Jesus. He's never met a Christian. He's never read anything about what the faith involves. However, when he listens to the radio or watches TV, he sees examples of Christian extremist right groups like the KKK beating and killing innocent people. And that's the only thing he knows. So what would you expect that little boy to think about what Christians were like if that's the only information he was exposed to? You couldn't fault him for him thinking that all Christians are terrorists, because that's the only thing he sees on TV.
This is Travel with Rick Steves. We're talking with George Goryeb. He's co-founder of the Mideast Peace Project in New York City, designed to better understand Islam and the Muslim faith in our society. George shares a powerful hour-long lecture on what is Islam in the lectures page at ricksteves.com. You know, George, we've got a few minutes left, and if you don't mind, I'd like to just go really quickly, just so we can understand some of the basic tenets of Islam, or just kind of for the typical American traveler, as you were when you started this decades-long study, and as I've always been. I'll just quickly review the five pillars or requirements of Islam. You have to profess faith in one God. You've got to give to charity. You've got to fast during the month of Ramadan, and you need to make a pilgrimage to Mecca if you can, and you're supposed to pray five times a day. The religion itself is based on a holy book, just like Christians have the Bible. Muslims have the Quran. Tell us what the Quran is.
Well, what you need to know when you want to understand what the holy book, the Quran, is that it was communicated to an illiterate, uneducated man named Muhammad, who lived approximately 600 years after Jesus was crucified. He was born and raised in Saudi Arabia. At the age of 40, he was meditating in the desert at night, and Muslims believe that he was approached by the archangel Gabriel, who commanded him to recite. And he protested because he said, "I don't know how to read. I can't read and write. I can't recite." And the angel persisted three times, commanding him to recite. And finally, he did. And he repeated what the angel was conveying to him. And Muslims believe that this was divine, inspirational revelation directly from God. Now, Muhammad would return to the city in the daytime, and he would repeat what he was instructed at night. And scribes would write down exactly word for word what he was told by the angel Gabriel. And this series of revelations continued for the rest of Muhammad's life for 22 years, resulting in a book called the Quran, which in Arabic means the recitation or the reading. And for Muslims, it is a perfect book. And by the way, for the last 14 centuries, since it was first written down, it has remained 100% consistent. Every word, every line, is exactly what every Quran that's over 1,000 years old has inside.
Which is so different from Christianity, because now every decade you get a new version of the Bible in today's language and so on. So I understand this is a 77,000-word poem, and it is very, very beautiful to hear. It's like a Shakespeare sonnet or something like that.
Yes.
And there's something about the hypnotic beauty of the words in there that are just... they're inspiring beyond what I could imagine. I mean, you have to understand the Arabic, and it's a powerful book that way. Another thing that's interesting is we have a tough time with these three great monotheistic religions. And in our country, we call a lot of things Judeo-Christian, kind of thinking that the Jewish faith and the Christian faith have a lot in common, implying more than the Muslim faith. What is your take on who has more in common, and how these three great religions relate to each other?
I like to quote a very dear Israeli friend of mine who's a professor of conflict resolution at a university in Washington, D.C. She's Jewish, and she married a Moroccan who's Muslim. And she told me once that she felt like Muslims and Jews have far more in common than Jews and Christians, because there's so many things, so many rituals and dietary restrictions and beliefs that are very, very consistent between Muslims and Jews. And I find it ironic that we always refer to the Judeo-Christian ethic when we really should be referring to the Judeo-Christian Islamic ethic, because Islam incorporates the teachings of the Jewish Bible and the Christian Bible together with the Quran. Muslims have to read all of those.
And the Christian Bible is centuries older than the Muslim Quran.
That's right.
You know, this few minutes that we've had a chance to talk just reminds me of how much we can benefit just by having an interest in Islam.
Absolutely.
It's certainly not going to go away. It's going to be filling the headlines for the rest of our lives. And we can't learn about it by looking at the evening news. We've got to make some Muslim friends. We've got to travel, get out of our comfort zone, break bread with people. And any chance I get to see something positive in another religion, I like to try to do that. The call to prayer, five times a day, for me, it's this global, cosmic wave of praise spinning around the planet as fast as the world spins, from Malaysia all the way to Morocco and beyond. Do you know what I mean, how that can be a beautiful thing?
Yes, I always found that the fact that Muslims will take a 10-minute break in the middle of their day to communicate with God is just a reminder of how important God is in their life every day. They never feel separated from God. And I've had experiences in my life where I say an example where I was buying some jewelry one time in a jewelry store in Saudi Arabia. It was my first time there. I'd already lived in a Muslim country, several Muslim countries. But in Saudi Arabia, which is probably the most strict out of the 55 predominantly Muslim countries on earth, they shut everything down for 10 minutes. Whenever it's prayer time, everything stops. I was in the middle of buying jewelry and the guy kicked me out of the store and I had to wait on the sidewalk until 10 minutes was up and I came back in.
And when you're traveling in Islam, there's this, for me, wonderful cacophony of sounds as all of the minarets have their tinny speakers and everybody is hollering what are they saying at the call to prayer?
Allahu Akbar. They're chanting Allahu Akbar. God is great, God is great. There's only one God and Muhammad is his prophet. That is the profession of faith. That is the central tenet of the Islamic faith.
We hear that five times a day from all the minarets. It's, again, a reminder
of
how...
It is beautiful.
It's a beautiful thing to me. And yes. It's a good reminder of how religion permeates people's lives in Islam. George, thank you so much. And thanks for all you do to help us better understand each other.
Thank you very much, Rick. I appreciate it. This has been a very good conversation, and I'm grateful.
You can view George Goryeb's lecture on Appreciating Islam from a link on our website. Look for it with this week's show at ricksteves.com/radio. Lori Erickson is an Episcopal deacon, and she's developed a following for writing about spiritual discoveries in her travels. She investigated the types of rituals and traditions people employ to deal with the realities of death in her book, Near the Exit. And she shares discoveries about her Viking ancestors in The Soul of the Family Tree. She joins us now from our affiliate, Iowa Public Radio, to look at the meaning behind those colorful prayer flags you see flying from monasteries in Tibet, and quite possibly in an office cubicle or backyard patio near you. Tibetan prayer flags, they flap colorfully in the wind. You see them climbing in the Himalayas, or you see them in your neighbor's backyard. What do they mean? Writer Lori Erickson is our guest today on Travel with Rick Steves, and Lori writes about the intersection of travel and spirituality. Her latest book is The Soul of the Family Tree. She's written about these prayer flags and joins us now for a little insight. Lori, tell us about, these prayer flags. First of all, you see them on dramatic spots in the Himalayas, but now you see them more than ever right here at home in the United States. What do they mean?
I think they mean a variety of things to people. I think to some people, they're decorations. And I think it's unfortunate that they don't realize the deeper meanings behind Tibetan prayer flags. And I should say, first of all, I'm not a practitioner of Tibetan Buddhism, but I actually have studied it a fair amount and have been to a lot of temples and have gotten a deeper understanding of these flags. And I think it's a beautiful tradition, but I think people should know more about it maybe before they start putting up those flags.
Right.
So the idea is that there are sacred images that are printed on these flags, and they're in sacred colors, blue, white, red, green, and yellow, always in the same order. Each of those colors have symbolic meaning.
So you wrote in your article, you wrote blue is for heaven, white is for air, red is for fire, green for water, and yellow for earth. So it covers the whole gamut there.
Right. And a very common image that's on these flags is the wind horse, which is a mythical animal that actually dates back to pre-Buddhist Tibet. And the idea is that the wind horse carries prayers from earth to heaven. And it's also believed that when the prayer flags flutter in the wind, that the wind carries the prayers as well, and it spreads them far and wide, spreading Buddhist teachings on love and compassion. And I think, too, another part of the meaning of these flags is they're not meant to be put up for personal, for selfish reasons, that they're very much meant to be a blessing for the larger world. And I think that's such a wonderful lesson right there, that they're beautiful in and of themselves, but they are really meant to bless the world and that the wind does that.
I love that. Your phrase was blessings spoken on the breath of nature. Like a drop of water impacts the sea. When the wind hits those flags, it broadcasts. It's essentially a spiritual broadcast, that little wind power.
Right, right.
It's a beautiful thing. And also, it's interesting to me, there's so much heritage and history in there. I mean, a lot of those, the images on the prayer flag, They go back 5 centuries to Chinese woodblock paintings, and some Buddhist master would actually create an original design centuries ago, and that design would still be used.
And a lot of this tradition, too, actually has its roots in the pre-Buddhist traditions of Tibet as well. So it goes much farther back even than 500-600 years. So, you know, when you look at those flags, you really are seeing an ancient tradition that lives in the modern world. And it, to some extent, is being reinterpreted. But I think that once people learn even a little bit about Tibetan flags, I think they immediately see the beauty of the larger symbols involved.
You know, I think that's really important because I've got some neighbors that fly their Buddhist prayer flags, and I don't think they're necessarily Buddhist, but they embrace that sort of idea of peace and compassion and so on. I guess if you're going to fly the prayer flags of another religion, you should understand the importance of them from that religion's point of view. For instance, the prayer flags are supposed to be treated with the same respect that we would treat our stars and stripes. I mean, when it's old and worn, you don't just throw it away. It should be apparently burned to release those blessings.
That's right. And the flags are not to touch the floor or the ground for a similar reason. You want to treat them with respect. And yeah, I think it's important that people honor those traditions if they're going to use Tibetan prayer flags.
Well, Laura, you have a fascinating passion, I think, for taking your interest in spirituality as an Episcopalian deacon and as an avid traveler, and then weaving it together in what you learned through your travels. Your latest book, The Soul of the Family Tree, talks about mixing genealogy and exploring your ancestors with travel. And just a little bit of thought about the importance of Tibetan prayer flags. Now, as a Christian minister or deacon, when you look at these prayer flags, I like the positive spin you put on it. You don't need to actually be a practitioner of this religion or that religion, but I like it when you find no contradiction in embracing something that is universal between cultures.
I think so often religion becomes a point of conflict between people and a point of division. But I think if you go to a deeper level, the points of connection, the threads of connection are so much more powerful. And, you know, the power of prayer, the power of forgiveness, you know, the appreciation for the power of nature, the beauty of nature, those are found in virtually all religions that I know of, at least. And we can stand side by side with people and be in solidarity and not say the same prayers, but, you know, breathe the same sacred air. And I think that that's all to the good. And it's one of the reasons why I love traveling to sacred sites around the world.
I love because, that. Yes. Blessings spoken on the breath of nature. When we look at those prayer flags, regardless of whatever religion we embrace or no religion at all, we can be mindful of the fact that it's just important to be tuned in to the welfare of all beings and mindful of the need to be compassionate and kind and joyful. I'll look at these Tibetan prayer flags a little differently next time. Thanks so much, Lori.
Thank you, Rick, for having me.
Lori Erickson is working on a new book that she calls A Spiritual Geography of America, From Appalachia to Alaska. It's set to be released in September. There's more on her website, LoriErickson.net. And Lori is spelled L-O-R-I.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tatton. Our associate producers are Kasmira Hall and Donna Bardsley. We get website support from Andrew Wakeling, affiliate promotions from Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. When you're on a road trip, you can listen to Travel with Rick Steves on one of more than 500 other radio stations. You'll find a list of when and where we're broadcast at ricksteves.com/radio.